Robert Moffat, pioneer Bible translator. Robert Moffat was brought up near Edinburgh in Scotland by devout Christian parents who filled his heart and his mind with accounts of the exploits of missionaries in other countries. After being apprenticed as a gardener and a brief experience as a sailor, Robert Moffat determined to join the London Missionary Society. However, his first application was rejected, but undaunted, this Scot tried again the next year and he was accepted. In October 1816, at Surrey Chapel, London, Robert and eight others were set apart for the work of the London Missionary Society. And one of the others who was consecrated at that time was John Williams, who was destined to lose his life at the hands of cannibals in the South Seas on the Pacific Islands much later. But Robert Moffat set sail for Africa and he arrived in Cape Town January 1817. The government officials frowned on the missionary activity as being likely to provoke unrest amongst the natives of the interior. The journey into the interior was long and dangerous and it was arduous. He came near death on several occasions, including from lions, from poison, and from starvation. Robert was shocked at the low standards of behavior and the prevalent immorality as he set out to establish a mission station amongst the tribes along the Orange River. However, his first missionary journey was blessed with the conversion of the most notorious bandit and murderer in the country, a man called Afrikaner. His name was synonymous with terror. He was a killer who had murdered a white farmer and his family, and he was feared throughout the territory. When Robert returned to Cape Town with this criminal, the entire community was stunned at the obvious transformation of this notorious savage into a gentle and a humble Christian. In December 1819, Mary Smith, whose parents had initially refused permission for her to marry Robert Moffat, was finally allowed to go, and she arrived from England to marry Robert Moffat in Cape Town. So together they set out for Bechuanaland, what today is called Botswana, and they settled at Kuruman in what is today the Northern Cape. For the next 50 years, the Moffats would develop this mission station into a model which many others copied in later years. Mary and Robert became one of the greatest husband-wife missionary teams in history. Their prospects for success seemed very bleak. The Tswanas were gripped by witchcraft and they threatened the Moffats and they demanded that they left. But the resolution of the Moffats in standing their ground completely amazed the Tswana people, who declared they'd never seen such bravery before. This is a painting of the, or sketch, of the chapel they built at Kuruman. During a tribal war, Robert Moffat's intervention secured peace, saved many lives, and got a lot of deep respect and gratitude. Here you can see how far they were from, for example, Victoria Falls, 1,445 kilometers away, Algoa Bay, which is Port Elizabeth, 920 kilometers south. This is the church they built. But it was 9 years before the first converts were baptized and the church at Kuruman established. Imagine working for 9 years in the field before you get your first convert. After learning the Tswana language, Robert Moffat translated the Westminster Catechism and some great hymns of the Reformation into Tswana. He was the author of the very first hymn in Tswana. He translated the Gospel of Luke into Tswana, ultimately the whole Bible. This was the very first complete Bible to be translated into an African language. After painstaking work in translating the Gospel of Luke, Moffat travelled to Cape Town to have the translation printed, but he was found to find no work printers willing to accept the work. He realised the only alternative was to print it himself. So he was forced to learn printing trades and he acquired a printing press. This is the oldest printing press north of the Orange River, which is still at Kuruman. He took this back with him to Kuruman, and by 1840 the new test was completed, and to print this required that he return to England, because he could print it maybe, but he couldn't get it bound. He needed to take it to be bound to England. During his time in Britain, he spoke at a meeting which challenged David Livingstone David Livingston at this stage was determined to go as a missionary to China. And when David Livingston heard Robert Moffat's challenge of the smoke of 1,000 villages where the name of Christ had not yet been preached, David Livingston shifted his focus from Asia to Africa, and a good thing he did. And David Livingston later became Robert Moffat's son-in-law when he married Mary. By 1851, Moffat had completed the translation of the Old Testament into China. It had taken him 29 years to translate the whole Bible into China. He also wrote the book Missionary Labors and Scenes in South Africa, which I have, and he translated Pilgrim's Progress, the greatest best-selling book in English language, into the China language. How many people here have read Pilgrim's Progress? John Bunyan's book. Well worth reading. If you haven't read Pilgrim's Progress, you're missing out. It's one of the greatest books ever. It's the bestseller after the Bible in the English language in all of history. So, Pilgrim's Progress was read 50 times in Charles Spurgeon's life. Charles Spurgeon said he read Pilgrim's Progress 50 times. It's his favorite book. Can you imagine reading a book 50 times? And he preached for it many a time. Robert Moffat was a tireless evangelist. On one visit to a neighboring village, he was awakened by the eager clamor of the natives who had gathered. And he preached to them, and then he retired to wash for the first time that day. He returned to his tent to breakfast, only to find the people had gathered for a second sermon. How good when people are that hungry that they don't even let the missionary finish his breakfast. They wanted to give them more message. So the hunger was great. The people listened attentively. They discussed what they'd heard. Later that day, they came back for a third service. Now, when you have that kind of hunger and eagerness to learn, that makes one's work easy. Another amazing achievement of Robert Moffat was he developed a friendship with Mzilikazi, the king of the Madibili, in what is today Zimbabwe. Mzilikazi was a vicious tyrant. I think today we'd call him a dictator. Feared by his people and the long-suffering neighboring tribes, many of whom were enslaved by him. But Mzilikazi developed a strong friendship with Robert Moffat, which lasted 30 years. Quite extraordinary. Mzilikazi was a general of King Shaka of the Zulu. And it's said that Mzilikazi and his men killed something like 1.9 million people in the Mifokan. One of his bloodthirsty, they called it the Path of Blood. One of his biographies is called the Path of Blood. Mzilikazi's Madibili looted and pillaged and destroyed their way across most of what today is the Orange Free State in Transvaal. So when the Boers moved into that area, it was depopulated because the Madibili had slaughtered virtually everybody throughout these areas. And in the Transvaal, the Madibili of Mzilikazi were rampaging, and only when the Boers got there and they had a fight at Vredenburg did Mzilikazi take his people north of the Limpopo into what today is Madibili land in Zimbabwe. And to think the London Missionary Society proposed to establish a mission amongst the Madibili who were feared. And Robert's own son, John Moffat, was the first to volunteer for this daunting task of establishing a mission base amongst the Madibili. Robert Moffat had the satisfaction of seeing his work in Kuruman reproduced 700 miles north by his own son. These were the first missionaries amongst the Madibili. Now, of the 7 children born to Robert Moffat, 5 became actively involved in missionary service. His daughter became a teacher at the mission school at Kuruman. You can see only one of his children was born in England, that was Jane. Elizabeth married London Missionary Society Robert Pierce and had 15 children. James died of measles age 6. Elizabeth died within a year of her birth. Many missionaries' children died in the field because of lack of medical facilities. Helen was baptized with the first convert to the mission and married James Vasuvi. She had 8 children. Robert, a trader, died aged 35, leaving his wife and 5 children. Another Robert died aged 5 days. He is the first to be buried in a mission cemetery in Kuruman. Anne married the French missionary Jean Pedrux, who was murdered in 1866, leaving 7 children, all under the age of 15. And his youngest, Mary, married David Livingston. She died of fever in the Zambezi Valley. She's buried in Mozambique in Tet Province. Robert and Mary married in Cape Town, the Rock Perum in 1820, and they worked there for 50 years before retiring to England. Education and literacy training was always of great importance in Robert Moffat's missionary strategy. In 1870, after 53 years of service in Africa, 50 years of which was at Kuruman, the Moffats finally retired to Britain, and his last 13 years were devoted to promoting the cause of Christ in Africa, travelling the length and breadth of the British Isles, mobilising vast amounts of prayer warriors, supporters and actual missionary volunteers who came to Africa and blessed the continent. Now here's a snapshot of Africa at about the world at the end of the Moffat's ministry. In 1887, this was the statistics. The number of population in the world was 1.4 billion people, so 1,427 million people in the whole world, of which 116 million were Protestants, that's the yellow. Orthodox Christians, mostly in Russia, 84 million. Catholics, 190 million. Mostly in South America, of course. Muslims, 170 million. And Jews, the little bits of blocks of blue in the middle, 8 million. Heathen, 856 million. But that included those three little yellow blocks in the middle of 3 million converts from the missionaries so far of the 19th century. So each square represents 1 million souls. That gives you an idea of what the world's population was broken down in a kind of Operation World survey. Although Robert Moffat was overshadowed by his famous son-in-law David Livingstone, he is often referred to as the father-in-law of David Livingstone, Robert Moffat was actually the more effective evangelist and Bible translator and educator of the two. When you go to London Missionary Sunday Mission at Kuruman, you see this plaque on the wall giving the names of the missionaries. It served there, Robert Hamilton, James Reed, third, Robert Moffat. And you see, if you go seven down, there's David Livingstone. So some very famous missionaries served at Kuruman. I visited this mission station, and many of the pictures you've got here I took on that visit. David Livingstone was, without doubt, the greatest missionary explorer and the most effective campaigner against the slave trade in Africa. But it's to Robert Moffat that the honor belongs. Of the first translation of the complete Bible into an African language, the Tswana language. What a privileged people. Now, this is what the bookshelves look like at the Kuruman Mission Station. They need to look after it better. It's not very neat. But some of the biographies that I've got include Lives of Robert and Mary Moffat by John Smith Moffat, one of their children, and Life and Labors of Robert Moffat by William Waters. There is a chapter on Robert Moffat in the Greater Central Missions book, and of course you've got it as chapter 9 in your Christian History of Africa manual. But let me show you some more pictures. From this is the chapel that they built at Kuruman, still standing, and a painting of Kuruman London Missionary Society years ago. When I went there, you get to a junction of the road. I traveled from Kimberley, and there's a sign, one direction is to Kuruman and the other direction is to Hot as Hell. So you get a junction road, you can choose to go to Hot as Hell or to Kuruman London Missionary Center. 14 hectares at the edge of the Kalahari. The first Tswana person was baptized here. The first time the Bible was translated to Tswana and printed here. David Livingstone first made his name in Africa based at Kuruman Mission Station. The earliest schoolroom and houses north of the Orange River there. The Moffat's church has stood for over 150 years. They labored there for 50 years. The first Tswana to be ordained was Mafakele Lekalaki. And in one generation, God's Spirit is breathing new life into this most holy place, conservation area. You can come and see the Moffat Mission Station. They have a beautiful garden, and this archway commemorates the arrival of the London Missionary Society and 200 years of mission by congregational churches in South Africa. Quoting from Hebrews 12, we are surrounded by so great a cloud of witnesses. not only in the book of Hebrews chapter 11, but in church history. So walking around the mission station, you could see signs of the hard work done, like the well, and well laid out sleeping quarters, operations areas, and the psalmist says, the missionary road to the interior, it ran through Panama for many, many generations. If people on the way to the north, like David Livingstone, that had passed through Kuruman. Crawfornet is where David Livingstone stopped on his way up to Kuruman. He stayed at the Andrew Murray family home, the parsonage of the Dutch Farm Church in Crawfornet. David Livingstone, the prettiest town in Africa, Crawfornet. Cape Town, 1,195 kilometers away. To think David Livingstone walked all the way from Kuruman down to Cape Town to return his family to the ship and then later walk back. And he initially started by walking the 920 kilometers from Port Elizabeth up to Kuruman, walking. Now I've heard some students saying they were delayed coming back because of waiting for bus fares. Well, David Livingstone didn't wait for the bus. He walked. And he walked to Victoria Falls and way beyond. The Moffat family lived in his homestead from 1826 to 1870. The house was once a residence, later a boarding school, a church, a storeroom, an office, and a bookshop over the years. This building. This is the Moffat's home. Again, this is a tribute to good workmanship. To build a house and for the house still to be standing and working 150 years later. That's a tribute to the builders. And look at this. Here you've even got King Edward VII's seal on this postbox, dating it. You know, all around Britain right now, they're changing their postboxes and stamps and money from Elizabeth II to Charles III. And so we've got one here at the Orange River Colony. That dates it. That goes right back to before 1910 when South Africa became a union of South Africa, when it was still Orange River Colony before it became Orange Free State. Weighing pigs for the post office. You put your parcels in here and they'd weigh it. A sundial in the garden. Before watches, people use sundials to tell the time, which is very approximate, but still. So this is the Moffat homestead. And inside their dining room, they've got a model of it and paintings on the wall. You see, I've got some of the pictures from my visit here. The trunk, London Missionary Society trunk. When you travel by ship, people often put things in trunks that would not be easy to carry. You'd have a handle at each side. It'd be probably a two-man job. Their bookcase needs to be looked after better. Books are valuable. We should value the library. May encourage everyone to be readers. Looking at the library yesterday, the records, it seems that the average student has only taken up two books so far this year. And some have taken up less, some have taken up more, but the average is about two books so far in the first half of this year. I don't see how one can be a very effective student if you're not regularly visiting the library and regularly checking out more books than that. It would really challenge you to be readers. Mrs. Moffat's kitchen. Mary Moffat was an extraordinary missionary and a great help to Robert Moffat. These are some of Robert Moffat's journeys. You can see most of these through Bechuanaland, what today is Botswana, and in southern, what today is southern Zimbabwe, Madibeland in particular. The Moffat Bible in China, their clock on the wall, some of the communion elements in the cupboard, their children, and some early photographs from long ago of what Kuruman looked like, a painting of Robert Moffat, and one of his hymn missionary services. Notice what's the hymn on the back of this order service? From Greenland's Icy Mountains. I trust you all know this hymn. It's the most important hymn of the greatest century missions. Everyone in missionary movements, I knew this hymn off by heart back in the 19th century. They could sing it without notes because, or words because they knew it off by heart. It was that popular. People just started off and spontaneously it was known. This was a bench. Obviously, lately it hasn't been looked after very well. The Livingston tree, Mary Martha's garden. Here, Livingston says he learned the truth of Jesus' words. There is no one who has left house or brothers or sister or mother or father or children or lands for my sake for the gospel who will not receive a hundredfold back. Because in this garden, he met Mary after he'd been mauled by the lion. She helped nurse him back to health. And so, David Livingston proposed to Mary Moffat, the youngest of Robert Moffat's children, in this garden, and he gained another family, of course. In 1844, Livingston was injured by a lion. The Moffat's daughter Mary nursed him back to health in Kuruman. He proposed to her under this almond tree, which isn't there anymore, but it's where the tree was. I'm not sure what happened over the years, but this tree has obviously died. And here they were re-thatching the roof at the Moffat Church, built in 1829, completed 1838. Stonemason was Hugh Millen, convert from mission helped. It's so important to remember the people who did the hard work. I see you've got here who did the building of the auditorium and the library, and these things should be remembered. Remember the people who laid the foundations. We benefit from so much hard work that others have done in generations before. The Moffat's first church, just made of wood and thatch, and later a magnificent church building, which is strongly built. And you can see the church bell above. And notice they've also got the tall pole. You know what the tall pole is for? It's a lightning conductor. You don't want lightning striking a thatched roof. So they have a lightning conductor. If there's lightning near there, it will be attracted to the metal, go down to the ground and be dispersed harmlessly instead of striking the roof. And so it's quite common in Transvaal to see these lightning conductor metal poles next to a church, especially a thatched roof church. You don't want lightning. The door of the church bell, and commemoration of how important this place is in the history of the church. Part of the Restoration Award, they got an award for how they were restoring the mission station in 2002. The roll of honor of the people who have served as missionaries at this mission station. And that's the pulpit. It's built like a T-junction, so it's a broad front, and then it's got a narrow rectangular nave going down the center. Now, you can see the symbol of the congregational churches is the cross and the dove of the Holy Spirit coming down. Very nice, well-built, strong pulpit. They've got a safe in the wall where people can drop their money as offerings for the work. The thatched roof, very well done. There you can see the lightning pole. And the old thatch, new thatch. The first schoolroom built north of Orange River was built here. And the school was built by Aaron Joseph's two companions. Moffat wrote the work was a voluntary act on their part without the subject of once being hinted at. Aaron Joseph was once an escaped slave, came to the mission for the education of his children. He bought his freedom, $1,500. Raised by selling elephant tusks, was baptized here. The 50th ordinance was issued while they were building the school and was confirmed 15 Jan 1829. So some of the history is right here. The first printing press. There's a classroom they built here. Today it houses the printing press on which the first Bible in Africa was printed. Quite important history. Baby Robert Moffat was buried in the cemetery. The earliest written inscription in Swana appears on his gravestone, which appears here. Here lies the body of Robert, the son of Robert and Mary Moffat. And then it has it in Swana as well. So they were rethatching the roof when I was visiting, but this is what the schoolroom looked like and later the prison room. And all around the side they've got leaflets, books, manuals, which got printed on this printing press by Robert Moffat at the mission station. This is the front page of the John Bunyan, Pilgrim's Progress in Tswana. Can anyone here speak Tswana or read Tswana? Who can? Right. So, as you know, so Baba Shai speaks Tswana since he was small. But Pilgrim's Progress in Tswana would be good to track it down and find it. And many other books that were produced in the Tswana language. The Lord's Prayer, the Ten Commandments, first printed here in Tswana language. This is the printing press. Notice the old printing press, you have to put one page down at a time and close it like a vine press. And then it was lifted up. So it wasn't just shooting out like the photocopier. It was one page at a time. Laborious. But the London Mission Society was founded in 1795 AD, I would say. Let us not fall into the trap of the pagans of not using the initials for our Lord. AD is Christian, CE is not. This common error business is a pagan attempt to replace Christianity. Like when I was converted, if any job application site had, what is your Christian name and your surname? Now it's first name, last name, or surname. They've taken out Christian name, they've taken out Sunday being the Lord's name, and now they're trying to even take away other dates. This is 2023. 2023 what? In the year of our Lord. What's the greatest event in history to split the calendar into two? Into BC, before Christ, and AD, Anno Domini, in the year of our Lord. The coming of Christ. The world's calendars and dates, every time a person writes a date, they're acknowledging the centrality of Christ. That our dating system dates from when Christ came to this world, when he was born of the Virgin Mary. You don't want to lose that. Don't let people fool you into using CE and BCE before the common era, CE, common era. What common era? They're trying to ignore the fact that Christ is the central figure of history. So don't let people do what these fools here did of falling into the trap of CE instead of AD. The first book printed in South Africa was a Dutch publication on missionary work in Southern Africa at the Cape of Good Hope. It was published by the London Missionary Society. And here's Dr. Theophilus van der Kemp, who arrived at the Cape in 1799, the start of missionary era in Southern Africa. Well, for the Congregational Churches. But there was another missionary who came before this. Who was the first missionary to South Africa? Does anyone know the name? Or when he came? Or which missionary society came from? They say he's the first missionary to South Africa. That's not true. He's only the first Congregational missionary from the London Missionary Society. There's another missionary who predates this. Sorry? Philip who? No, definitely not. Now, the first missionary to South Africa, in the Southern Hemisphere actually, was George Smith. He came from Germany for the Moravian mission, for the brethren who followed Jan Hus's ministry. So there were Hussites, Moravia, Count Nicholas von Zinzendorf of Germany, sent out George Smith, who came to the Hottentots, the Khoisan, and established Carnarvondal. The oldest mission station in the Southern Hemisphere is Carnarvondal, about an hour and a half's drive outside of Cape Town. Anyway, just to correct what these people are saying. So, here they've got 1807, London Missionary Society sends its first missionary to China, Robert Morrison of Scotland. And not many people know who's the first Protestant missionary to China, Robert Morrison. Here, the Lord's Prayer is translated to Hottentot and to Kwarana by John Campbell, 1815. Lord's Prayer in the Hottentot or Khoisan language. First iron printing press invented by the Earl of Stanhope in England in 1800. The first shipment of English Bibles to the Cape of Good Hope came in 1806. With the British invasion, they brought Bibles. First shipment of Dutch Bibles to the Cape for the Khoisan was in 1810. Spelling book in Tswana language. So very interesting to visit there. So the number of copies that could be printed once they had a power-driven press was you could print 1,000 in an hour. I think your photocopier can do more than that. So isn't it amazing? We have such printing technology available today that can do so much faster. Today, we can have high-speed Gutenberg press and Heidelbergs in Cape Town that can print 12,000 pages in an hour and even full color. So printing has gone a long way since this, but we need to know our history. So this is all part of our heritage and history. And you can see behind glass displays of the different books and Sunday school materials produced in the Tswana language at Putuma. And this is the first London Missionary Society mission house built in Malabiland. It's good they've got a picture of it because it got burned down later by some Madibili warriors during the War of 1893. These are some of the early leaders of the church in Kuruman who were converted to South of the Train. Some of the early Sunday school books. And the Moffat Mission Trust brought the printing press back up from Cape Town to be at Kuruman Mission Station in 1996 on Heritage Day. The first printing press north of the Orange River. First known public library opened in the British Isles Guild Hall in 1425, and Gutenberg invented movable type in the 1440s. So, in the garden you see a memorial to Robert Moffat as well. You can see a man who spent a long time here, from a very young man, grew to be an old grey man with long beard in Africa. And this bronze is identical to the plaque at Ormondson in Scotland at his birthplace. And here you see David Livingstone's room. When his son-in-law, David Livingstone, had a second home, and so he stayed in these rooms during his visits. So here you get to David Livingstone's room. It's not a very big room at all. Livingstone walked across Africa for 26 years. There's a bust of him, metal bust. You can get something of this tough, hardened Scotsman who walked thousands of kilometers by foot. And it's not a very big room, but this is his room. It's now got lots of pictures and paintings to commemorate David Livingstone, but you can even see in the marriage register when he's married to Mary Moffat, and they've got that from the church, a marriage book. And of course, pictures of Livingstone's great events, like meeting the American journalist, Henry Morton Stanley, sawing off the yokes that were enslaving people on the banks of Lake Nyasa in Malawi. Reviews of his books, one of David Livingstone's daughters, and pictures of where he died and where his heart was buried. Even a coupon that got a person access to the funeral of David Livingstone at Westminster Abbey on the 18th of April, 1874, a year after he had died, finally got a burial. And again, seeing the coffin of David Livingstone, a view I got climbing up on one of the walls to get a picture of the mission station. You can see where they had the wheelhouse. There's quite a lot of reconstruction that's taking place, and they were particularly refactoring many of the roofs at that time, where the wagon would have been kept. Of course, the people traveled by ox cart almost anywhere, although David Livingstone came to walk next to the ox cart. He never sat in him. He thought that was a waste of an opportunity to stretch his legs and strengthen his muscles. So while the ox cart may have been carrying his family, he'd be walking alongside. And they've got irrigation canals for irrigating the gardens. We have a Livingstone 200 website. We can get a lot of great resources, picture galleries, and links to Livingstone and Robert Moffat's materials. And the dr.davidlivingstone Facebook page, you will find more resources and pictures you can share with others. It's in the Growth Century Missions book on David Livingstone and Robert Moffat and Mary Celeste's Samuel Crowe and others. But you'll find all this on the frontlinemissionsa.org website. Any questions on Robert Moffat, Crinuman, London Missionary Society? Questions, comments? Complaints? Yes. So David Livingstone died in 1873 in May. His body was finally buried. His funeral was a year later, on the 18th of April, 1874, in Westminster Abbey in London. So as I showed you the pictures on Monday, when the people are going like for the Queen's funeral or for the King's coronation recently, they have to walk around David Livingstone's tomb, which is right at the forefront of the entrance to Westminster Abbey. I showed you the picture showing the red carpet going around. So Livingstone is buried in London, but his heart was buried in Zambia, under the tree where there's now a great memorial in northern Zambia. You've got to go far off the main north road to get there. On the road to Tanzania, you must go west for about an hour before you get to Chitambo's village, and you can see the memorial for David Livingstone where he died. His followers found him on his knees praying next to his bed, if you can use the word bed, and in the thatched hut where he's staying. And they said his heart belongs in Africa, but he's an important man, a great man. We must hear that his body is taken back to his people and buried in his land. So imagine the hard work taking his body all the way back to the coast. And they had to smuggle it, because no chief wanted the dead body carried across their territory. So they had to hide his body, and they actually folded it in half, bound it up, so it didn't look like a body being carried. And they had to do a lot of their walking by night, or these villagers, the chief would have stopped them and forced them to pay a fortune more. And they didn't have that much bartering items, so it was a lot of ingenuity to get his body over 1,500 kilometers from where he died to the coast, walking, carrying, and finally entrusting it to a British naval unit in Dar es Salaam. Yes. They had to effectively embalm it. They first took out those organs that would decay, like the heart, liver, buried it there at the base tree. So it was very difficult. They knew, I think they had to have the body dry out first before they could bind it up, sort of mummify the body. When they got back to England, there was suspicion, could this be the body of Livingstone? And the doctors quickly identified this is definitely Livingstone, because the left shoulder was crushed, and they could see the lion's teeth marks in the shoulder. The man had tremendous pain, especially on cold weather. You know how cold weather things feel sore? Well, the injury from the lion crunching his shoulder bones, you can imagine, his left arm was never quite the same again afterwards. But they could see this must be Livingstone. Who else has lion's teeth marks in his shoulder bones? So his children, of course, identified his personal effects, but it was a doctor who identified this must be Livingstone. He's got unique markings there. I mean, who else has teeth marks in his shoulder? I don't know if anyone else has wrestled with a lion. I've actually wrestled with a lion. Vivian, the lioness, she was a friend of mine when I was small, and we would wrestle and roll around the ground. I got some serious scratches. Lions are big and strong, even when they're cubs. And when Vivian was fully grown, she had to be taken away and was given to Johannesburg Zoo. But I had visiting rights. And so sometimes I could walk into the zoo, and they'd let me into the enclosure to meet Vivian. Vivian had by then her own husband and children, but she would come and jump on me and lick me. And I remember hearing one boy shouting, "Mommy, Mommy, this lion is eating the little boy." But actually she was just licking me. And it was quite an extraordinary thing to have a lion as a friend. But she never forgot me. Years later I could go there to Joburg Zoo, and Vivian would remember. And lions are very affectionate to those who they consider part of their tribe, part of their family. But when you meet a lion, it makes all the difference that this lion is your friend or not. So remind people, one day when Jesus returns, he will not come back as a lamb, he will come back as a lion, the lion of the tribe of Judah. And when you see a lion charging at you, it makes all the difference to know this is my friend or not. When Jesus returns, you do not want to face him as your judge and enemy. You want to face him as your Lord and Savior. So I think we should remind people, it's not terrifying to face a lion if you're friends with a lion. But if not, it's the most terrifying thing imaginable. You feel very mortal and human when you see a lion charging at you. And I've had that experience. But of course, it was a friendly lion. But David Livingston faced an angry lion who had every right to be angry. I mean, he had shot the lion. So the lion had every right to grab him and fling him around like a rabbit is flung around by a dog, as he describes in his book. But just remember, you want to be friends with the lion. And Jesus is the lion. Has anyone here read any of C.S. Lewis's books? C.S. Lewis? Chronicles of Narnia? The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe? Aslan? Well, Aslan, the lion, is a figure of Christ. And when somebody asks, is he a tame lion? He's told, no, Aslan is not a tame lion. And Aslan rips the white witch to pieces. Aslan is not a tame lion at all, and our Lord is not tame. He isn't my Jesus. He is the King of Kings. If you meet some people will say to you things like, my Jesus would never condemn anyone to hell. My Jesus would not do this or that. You know what you say to people like that? You're right. Your Jesus wouldn't, because he doesn't exist. He's a figment of your imagination. Jesus is not your Jesus. He's not a tame lion. He is the King of Kings. He is the Lord of Lords. He's the Creator, the Eternal Judge, the Redeemer. He is not tame to do what we want. So when people come up with, well, my Jesus wouldn't do, he doesn't belong to you. You belong to him. He is the one who is the Commander in Chief. He gives the orders. I am the one who says, speak, Lord, your servant listens, and what you want me to do, your will be done, is my prayer. He must increase, I must decrease. But I think many people today have this funny idea, well, my Jesus must do this and that. For example, Archbishop Desmond Tutu said, he could never worship a God who's homophobic. If God doesn't accept homosexuals, then he couldn't worship him. If homosexuals are not allowed into heaven, I don't want to go there. Can you imagine speaking like that? Well, I don't think you need to worry. Because God would force him to go to heaven if he doesn't want to be. As he says, I could not worship a homophobic God. God is against homosexuals, I could not worship him. So to him, homosexuality and perversion is more important than who God is and what God has revealed in the Bible. That is pretty serious.